Return your calls, but the rent keeps going up and up and up.
Find out what you can do about it. Tune in to Housing Notebook, Mondays at 8 p.m. Reactionary
landlord. The time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. That's coming up, and it can only be heard here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. As long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. There's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. Plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
A whole lot of police cars. Leon Thomas there on vocals. Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, that unmistakable raspy voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and I've taken that fine movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Well, one of the benefits, and probably one of the hazards of writing for years at the Village Voice, was that we pretty much got to decide what we were going to write about. But every year, there'd be one issue where the editors ordered us to come up with what they wanted. And that was what they called the annual Best of New York issue. It was just a straight-out advertising deal where, you know, they would have us write about where to get the best dog grooming or the best gymnasium or all this stuff. It was, you know, I guess it was for everybody who didn't want to read my nonsense about the rascals in City Hall, but we're just looking for deals everywhere. But one year, kind of in protest of that, I decided to write an ode to New York City of the 1970s for one of those best of issues. And among my nostalgic musings, I talked about how in Park Slope, before the moneyed gentry seized control of the neighborhood, there had been at least 14 bars on 7th Avenue between Flatbush Avenue and 9th Street. I might have made that number up. I'm not sure. But all of those taverns at the time were friendly and affordable, and I noted that that was paradise compared to today's 7th Avenue, which was all latte and flower shops. So the piece paid a wonderful dividend because I got a very kind note from a reader who thanked me for that column and sent along a copy of a photograph that he had snapped in the dim light of one of those long-vanished taverns on Brooklyn's 7th Avenue. It showed a single patron at the bar bent over his 7 and 7 or whatever he was drinking, with the afternoon light slanting in the window and the bartenders staring away, lost in thought. It was just a great photo. The note was from a man named Larry Rasiopo, who told me he had grown up in that neighborhood, and he too wistfully recalled those taverns and their customers. He mentioned that he had, Mr. Rasiopo had long been the official photographer for the city's Department of Housing Preservation and Development, you know, the city agency that's supposed to police housing conditions and also is supposed to help create affordable housing. Well, that caught my attention because I'd written a whole lot about HPD and about housing stuff. And that was the beginning, as our friend Humphrey Bogart says, of a beautiful friendship. I got to know Larry Rasiopo and his extensive and I think pretty unique work photographing the city of his birth. Eventually, I wrote an essay for one of his books, a really terrific volume called Brooklyn Before, which focused on the people and the streets of what was then known just as South Brooklyn. And I also took a look at some of the stuff that Mr. Rasiopo turned out from his day job at the City Housing Agency, where he had remarkable documentation of the destruction and the rebirth of the city's neighborhoods. His job just gave him, I guess, a marvelous ability to tour the city's neighborhoods. And while he was snapping his official photos, he also, I guess, took great note of all the unofficial emblems on the streets, everything from street murals to homemade basketball hoops to Christmas decorations. Mr. Rasiopo told me he was 22 years old when he started taking pictures. He started out with his neighbors in his neighborhood, and he snapped away on the streets. He got the last horse-drawn vegetable wagon in South Brooklyn. He had the photo to prove it. And his camera lens picked up all those little things that slip past most of us in our daily rush, when the simple beauty of things like the laundry lines in a backyard and the cracked concrete with the grass growing through it in a playground. His pictures weren't bleak, though. They were filled with hope, and the people he portrayed, though they were definitely not too well off, were clearly enjoying and making the best of their lives. Larry Rasiopo has done a slew of books of his photos. He's done one on Coney Island, both the old Coney and the new, and another called B-Ball NYC about those basketball hoops I mentioned. And another great one called The Word on the Street focuses on religious symbols. And yet another titled Halloween, of all the spooks and witches and creepy costumes donned by the kids he's run into on Halloween Eve. When he did that book, Brooklyn Before, he got a real photography critic, the great Julia Von Haften, who's curated photographs for the Museum of the City of New York and the New York Public Library. And she noted that Larry Rasiopo shares in what she noted was Walt Whitman, another Brooklynite's, description of photography as a democracy of vision. Oh, what a great link to make, I thought. She's absolutely right, I think. Larry Rasiopo's managed to find gold on just about every city block. He's justly gotten more than a few awards. He's had a Guggenheim Fellowship, awards from the National Endowment of the Arts, New York State Council on the Arts. Enough from me. Larry Rasiopo, welcome to WBAI. Thanks for being here this evening.
Tom, what a great introduction. Thank you.
Right, my pleasure. Maybe let's just start with the neighborhood, your own neighborhood. You told me about your parents' home got in the way of a Robert Moses project. Bulldozers demolished it to make way for the Prospect Expressway. But your family didn't move out. They stayed in Brooklyn. Would you mind just walking us through the neighborhoods you knew as a youth?
My family lived on 6th Avenue between 17th and Prospect. And there were two or three houses left on the corner, and there's a big gap where the expressway is, and the houses continue. My mother's mother lived on the corner of 18th and 6th. Her three sisters lived on the same block, so it was really our family center. And for some reason, my dad liked my mother's family, basically, I think, more than he liked his own, and they lived on near 30th Street and 5th Avenue, right by the Greenwood Cemetery. So we spent most of our holidays with my mother's family. And I was the oldest of 18 grandchildren for my grandmother. So I grew up, although I had one sibling, I felt like I had a big family. Mm. We were together a real lot. You played in the street together. And I grew up with a lot of love and a lot of what you described very well. We may not have had a lot, but we were very well provided for. We never seemed to miss anything important. And most of the people in our neighborhood lived the same way, so you really had a commonality of living where people did the same things, played the same games, and the parents went to work, and the kids went to school. And after school, we played till it got dark.
I think you told me that you had an uncle.
In my book, the same thing. the kids were doing the same thing when I was photographing.
I think you told me you had an uncle, or at least one uncle, who worked down on the waterfront, on the docks.
Well, no, it was my father and five of my uncles.
Five of your uncles, there you go.
And I think if it wasn't for the 60s, you know, and the changes in the 60s, I might have been down there. And my father, who didn't finish grammar school, really wanted me to get education and really encouraged me to go to high school and college. And scrimped to get money for Catholic school tuition. And he really didn't want me down the docks, although he wouldn't, you know, it would have been the worst thing. He made a nice life, good union benefits, which are hard to come by today, health care, as you know.
Sure. Sure.
It was a different world for working class people in Brooklyn.
And, you know, I when you picked up a camera, Larry Rasiopo, my understanding, you really didn't know a heck of a lot about it at first. Am I right? You hadn't been trained
in it. Some friends of mine were fooling around with the camera when I was in California. I was a VISTA volunteer in California from 1968 to 1970, part of the War on Poverty. Mm-hmm. It was called Volunteers in Service to America. Now it's AmeriCorps. And they were fooling around with the camera, and I borrowed it for a trip back to New York, and I really enjoyed the act of photographing. One of my uncles was a very good amateur photographer. He took all the family photographs. Maybe you remember those incredible 8mm movies with the giant lights blasting you in the face.
Yes.
At holidays.
Right.
And I remember liking it. I felt in a way, perhaps as a writer you would feel when you're on a story. I felt more alert, more aware if I had my camera. And I just really liked it. And I made a bunch of films, but we never had a lot of money to complete the films. And I have very few films in the can back from the 70s that were never finished. But with still photography, one alone could do the beginning, middle, and end. Right. So I just gravitated more and more towards taking pictures and learning about it. And rents were so cheap in South Brooklyn when I came back from California in 1970. I rented a complete storefront on Fifth Avenue for $35 a month. I set up my own darkroom.
Isn't that a beautiful thing? Sometimes I think you can spell the complete difference between then and now in four letters, R-E-N-T.
Yeah, I don't know how my young photographer friends do it.
But you found such rich pickings right around you. You did all the street fairs. You did the church processions. Right away, you just spotted all this stuff around you that called out.
I knew I was reading a little about photography. I knew about Eugene Smith. I saw a few shows in MoMA. I took one class at the School of Visual Arts. And like a lot of out-of-borough kids, I was intimidated by being Manhattan. Mm. And rather than keep going to the class, I set my own darkroom. But I just loved it. And I would just keep at it and look at photographs. There were some really good magazines around at the time. One was Camera 35. That in addition to all the techie stuff, they had a photo gravure section of different famous photographers like Walker Evans, or Diane Arbus, or Edward Weston, so you could actually see these beautiful prints. And I had something to aim for. I would make my prints and realize they didn't look like that. I'd go to MoMA every Thursday. MoMA was free. Mm. So I'd go to MoMA, look at the photographs, look at the collection, realize mine didn't look like that, go home and go back to work. And it was like a cycle. And when I teach now, I talk about photography as like farming. You plant, you wait, you harvest. You look at things, you plant, you harvest, and it's like a cycle, and you try and get better and try and pay attention.
What a great metaphor, the photographer as a farmer. You also shot a lot of your family. There's this marvelous picture that you took of your mother and, is it three of her sisters from 1971?
Yes.
It's like outside of...
Yeah.
It's outside a funeral parlor where I think you're...
It was the lunch break from the Italian funeral tradition, which is you go, there's a morning session, then lunch, then an evening session. And they were back. The funeral parlor was two blocks from my uncle's house. My first, second uncle passed away, my mother's oldest brother. And you would go to the funeral parlor and then come home, eat, talk, and go back for another 4 or 5 hours. It was kind of grueling. And they were all in black, and I asked to take their picture, and they lined up like something from a Hollywood movie.
It wasn't
my
just
mom and three sisters.
They were just standing facing you, though. Describe it.
Yeah, they were standing, and they just, I said, I take your picture, and they turned, and if you look at the picture, they're each touching each other. They lined up.
Yeah.
And turned to me like three quarter.
Yeah.
And it was actually still to this day, the first picture I thought, it made me realize I could do something, that I had something serious.
Isn't that something
I could accomplish as a photographer.
That's something. Well,
it really... black and white, simple Tri-X film, the cheapest film, a small range finder camera, black and white, and yet it still holds up.
It does. It does indeed. You were also drawn to parts of the borough of Brooklyn that were sort of sliding away. I mean, you went into the old Greenpoint Hospital. You went to the old decaying roller coasters of Coney. Yeah. What drew you to places like that?
Well, I just know Coney Island is like the mother lode for photography. If you look at my Coney Island book, I went there every other year, photographed something, just went for a walk. Sometimes we used to make movies there. You could just, the boardwalk was empty. Nobody bothered you. It was that kind of the... It was a time of benign neglect for the cities.
Right.
You were left to your, kind of left to your own devices. The Greenpoint Hospital was part of my job at HPD. HPD renovated one of the buildings there. And HPD was an amazing experience. I totally lucked into, which is a long story. But when I went there, I basically worked for the one division. You would know this, that there were five divisions in HPD, and the most interesting, most amazing one was property management, which is all the distressed and rent properties that the city was managing as kind of the landlord of last resort.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about this. It was alphabet soup to me. And through someone, I found out they needed a photographer in new construction. I've been working as a carpenter for 10 years, so I took the job as a trial. I told the person who hired me, I'll stay for a few weeks and see what it's like. I wound up staying there over 20 years. It was just an amazing opportunity to get into these places and go to different parts of the city that I didn't really know.
That's a great, great combination. Larry Rasiopo and the city's Department of Housing Preservation and Development. Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but the more important part is I'm talking to the great Larry Rasiopo, photographer, and I called you a photojournalist in the promo. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no hard line between art photography, documentary photography, commercial photography. You start out to do something, and sometimes you hit a home run. And sometimes it's just a paid assignment. Sometimes it's a serious document that's useful. You know, the best combine all three. I always think of the great American director, John Ford, who just worked. And sometimes you get a great script, and you turn it into the searchers. And sometimes you get the quiet man. And sometimes you get something that was just so-so. But it paid the rent. And it was basically all good because he was working.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel.
There you go. All right.
Well, and compared to doing manual labor, anything with photography is much easier.
Well, so I'm curious, at HPD, the city's housing department, what were your marching orders? What did they want you to do? we're separating it from what you might have done.
Fight injustice and protect the American way. No, it really was the first year I went to property management, and I was very, very pleasantly surprised that the people who worked there were really good, and I would say they were real humanitarians, and they wanted to help people. And I went to all these terrible places to try and document conditions so that they could be improved.
Mm-hmm.
And I was skeptical at first. I thought I would document this stuff, and then the people in charge, the powers that be, would dismiss it. And it turned out they really wanted to know what conditions were like so they could be remedied.
And they
created after the fact. So, and this is me, you know this more than I do. Like, I'm not a planner, but in order to do my job, basically in order to photograph any topic, the photographer has to learn a little bit about it, whether it's by experience or research or a combination. So I started paying attention. I was reading some of the agency materials, and I would be told to go to these buildings that were being renovated and take pictures, and I would find things that were done right. Sometimes I'd find things that were done wrong. And the saddest thing was, we go into a building, and they sent me with someone who had been a building manager and a writer. And we worked for a woman named Geraldine Perrine, who you know, who eventually became commissioner. At the time, she was chief of staff for another person you know, Bill Spiller, mm-hmm. who was a deputy commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And property management was like the stepchild of HPD, because it had the worst housing and the least amount of budget. And I would go into a building where, because of one of the lawsuits, the city was, again, this is almost accurate, but I would fact check anything I say, they would be required to fix an apartment because they were trying to get people out of the shelters. So say you'd be in a 20-unit building, four units on a floor, five floors, and you repair the apartment on the third floor, say 3B, and you repair that apartment inexpensively but new. Like you wouldn't, you put linoleum down, you put a new sink, a new bathroom, but all the simplest, like Home Depot kind. My wife's an interior designer, so I see all this high-end development when I photograph for her. This is bare bones, but good, clean, like sheetrock is sheetrock, insulation is insulation, and the apartments would be cleaned and painted, but the apartment across the hall, the apartment below, the apartment above was still wrecked.
Right.
And we'd go near the photograph, and the people would beg us. They'd say, please, can you fix my apartment? Right. I'm paying rent. Right. You're taking someone from the shelter.
Right.
And it was a crazy quote program, and the HPD eventually would try to renovate the whole building. And you have to move people out of your apartments. And people at first, my first few years, 89, 90, 91, people were very skeptical. They thought it was a trick to get them out of the building.
Sure.
But HPD had these really trained, devoted field people who really wanted to do a good job and work with people.
Hmm.
I was very impressed. I was ready to be like kind of like a lefty and skeptical about what the city was doing. But they really did do good work. Up against it, underfunded.
You know, out of some of your work, there came some pretty remarkable photographs of tenants in their apartments, just people sitting in their living rooms on a couch.
Right.
And, you know, how did that come about? They're all sort of looking at you, the ones I've seen anyways, and
well,
kind of
what
proud.
What I knew is when I was there, I felt they needed a human element. Like when you work for a magazine, if someone did a story for The Voice, you'd have certain things, but you want a few people to tag it to that would get people's attention, because human beings like to look at human beings. And in my best case, I did a lot of before and after pictures. I try and get this wrecked, destroyed apartment. And when I went back to the after, say a year later, I try and get the current tenant to pose there. Sometimes I did a building with a construction worker in the Bronx, and 2 years later I did the building super in front of this brand new, completely rehab building. So that's like, there was an old thing in the Daily News when I was a kid, Brooklyn Then and Now.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a picture, the same picture, 20 years, 30
right.
years apart.
Right.
So it always stuck with me that if you can put something in it to lock it. And a lot of the tenants now, I was a white guy in primarily a black or Latino neighborhood, and I felt I had to show, and it wasn't a fake thing to do. I felt natural respect for these people. They were living as best they can in some tough conditions. So I often said, can I take your picture? And the vast majority of people, when you asked them nicely and warmly and respectfully, said yes. There were always a few hard cases who said no, what are you doing? But people liked it. And in the midst of the most incredible, tough conditions, there were always these beautiful, shining kids. And I was gravitated to photographing them.
That's one of the things that stands out in those shots. I saw that they were recently put up. Maybe it's not so recently, but I saw it. I linked on your website by Urban Archive. Put up.
Yeah,
a bunch
and it's
of
really here. Interesting that the whole thing with the internet, the Brooklyn Children Museum found that site and contacted me about using the photographs in the exhibit, which is up now. It's called Brooklyn Voices, and they took a whole lot of my photographs and contacted me. I said, well, I don't own those photographs. Those are owned by the city. They're in the Department of Records. But I have a lot of other family pictures. So there's this exhibit up now with my work and a woman. And it has these pictures. Her name is Natalia Nakazwa. And it's my pictures and hers within a play environment for kids.
Hmm.
And it just opened last week at the Brooklyn Children's Museum.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Children's
Museum. It's really striking. And people say, how do you... And I just think people like to be respected and like to be noticed. Like if I say I'd like to take your picture, people like it. And at times I've learned that I might see a group of people and I want to take one person, and I take the other people also just so they don't feel left out.
Right.
Because no one likes to be left out.
Right.
Like maybe your friend is more beautiful, more interesting, but you don't want to be considered second rate. So I really get everyone. And what's interesting at HPD, because I went back to a lot of the same buildings, I was able to give prints back to people. I would sometimes bring prints back the next time I was in the building, which created a lot of good vibes
I'm
for me
sure.
and good vibes for the agency.
I'm sure. People, if it's a nice photo, they're going to want a copy. That's very generous of you. You know, I'm guessing here, I don't know if this is the way it worked, but that as you drove around the city and visited these sites and these buildings and neighborhoods around New York, that you started to notice some of the things that drew your eye as for your own work.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I took this job, and I was really struggling. I kind of had... I had an exhibit in 1982, a group exhibit, and I kind of lost my way as a photographer. I couldn't get any consistent work, any consistent play, and I had to pay the rent. I had my own apartment. So I started working with a few guys I met who were Cooper Union sculptor graduates. So also, they weren't discovered. Their artwork wasn't selling. And I met them through the Park Slope Food Co-op, and we wound up becoming carpenters. They were more advanced than I was. I started out just doing demolition. I loved the physicality of demolition. It was like better than going to the gym. But I got better. I paid attention. I started buying some tools. And we wound up having this funny little crew of carpenters that we couldn't work now because we had no insurance, no licensing, no anything. But we work in all these brownstones. We do like floor through cut renovations. And we were honest and we were reliable. And people trusted us, and we did a lot of really nice work. And then what happened was everybody wanted to make more money. So we had all, basically, is all cliche, all chiefs, no Indians. Mm-hmm. So everyone had to strike out on their own to make more money per hour. Mm-hmm. No one ever incorporated. No one ever got a real business. And we would hire each other from time to time. So one week I could be working for you. The next week you'd be working for me. Mm-hmm. It was this loose coalition of people. And it lasted for a long time, and I was really nearing the end. I was saying, I'm getting tired of this. I wonder what I will do next. And when I got this call about HPD.
Good timing.
It really was a life changer.
Good timing. All right.
And so I found myself driving around places like Bushwick or East Harlem that I really had not been. I was in and out of those neighborhoods in the 70s, and I drove a cab. I'd get a fare. I take a fare to Harlem. They say, listen, thanks a lot. Don't pick anyone else up. Get to the highway.
Well, I worked Harlem as a cab driver. I can tell you there was a lot of good fares up there. I can get you.
It was really unusual. This is back in the days of Black Pearl. We're not yellow. We go anywhere.
Uh-huh. Yes.
A lot of people now don't remember this part of the city. Yeah. You know, there's a big interest in the art world, in photography. Drew Rodriguez has a book about Taxi. My friend Merrill Meiser has a book about Bushwick and compares photographing in Bushwick to photographing at Studio 54. So there's this tremendous interest in the city in the late 70s. It was a really amazing time, as you know.
Right.
And so I was in Bushwick, and I was driving down a street to get to Broadway, and I almost put the car up on the sidewalk. I saw this abandoned giant movie theater. It was the old Bushwick.
Right.
And it became the Esquire. And it was just incredibly ornate and beautiful. And it was just abandoned and painted over. And I started noticing places like this, and I would go back on the weekend with a big camera. I've made several bodies of work using a big camera and also a panoramic camera. And that's how I got my Guggenheim. I photographed the inner city and the waterfront. So HPD was incredible for me. The people I replaced, had, you know, really, they didn't like the job. They were very good photographers, but they were turned off. And to me, it was a tremendous opportunity.
Right. Well, you loved the city. You had a feel for it.
I really do.
And you saw things like murals that were being painted.
I was struck by the murals were the first thing. Well, the first thing I did was really started to say, I would take pictures. This is for HPD. This is for me. Were the supers and the workers. I thought the supers were the frontline troops. Mm. Like there was a super in Bed-Stuy who I went up to the roof with him. He was trying to maintain the building, and on the roof were hundreds of spent casings. People were selling guns in the building, and they were going on the roof to demonstrate their wares. Mm. And here's this poor guy trying to keep water in the building, keep the floors clean, the doors working. And yet he was doing his best under these terrible conditions. I started photographing them first, and then I started seeing the memorial walls, the RIP walls. Martha Cooper and Joe Schroer did a beautiful book called RIP Walls. I was struck by how religious they were, the praying hands, the rosaries, the angels. It just reminded me of the mass cards that Italians have when there's a funeral.
Right. Yeah.
And I started just making, like, I have, like, picture 10 bar graphs, and the bars, some of them are bigger, some are small, and I've been adding to these projects. I've managed to publish five, and I have at least five or six more.
Five or
and
six
I'm just
more
adding graphs. And adding and adding to.
All right. We're going to take a short musical break here to play a tune that popped into my head as I was thinking and looking at Larry Rossiopo's photographs. Reggie Johnson, you want to hit that tune for us?
On the roof. On the roof. When this whole world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to
away from the hustling crowds up on the roof. I don't know. Larry, you talked a little bit once about going up on the roof when you had one of your places, cheapo rent with your friends on 7th Avenue.
We were on 9th Street. We had a big party to see the, I think it was 100th or 200th anniversary of Brooklyn Bridge.
Uh-huh.
It was on the corner of 9th Street and 7th Avenue. Right, we had a big party up on the roof.
Yeah.
And then it was frightening because I set the party up. All these people were coming, and I realized the roof cap was like 12 inches high, which is like death. I knew people would be drinking and smoking
right,
up there.
Right.
So I ran around. I went to my aunt's and got Christmas lights. And I put carpentry clamps that are like 2-3 feet high around with their lights on them to keep people off the edge. But you see the fireworks, you know, without the crowd, without the hassle of driving to downtown Brooklyn. You just wanted to see them and relax.
It's a great thing about Park Slope, I must say. When, you know, back in the day, at least you could, from that ridge line, you could always see the harbor if you got up on the roof.
Oh, yeah.
You could see the statue down there and the towers.
From my apartment on 6th Avenue that was torn down by Moses, from the kitchen window, you can see the Statue of Liberty.
It was really nice. Would you mind if we talked a little bit about what, I mean, there is a real religious theme that runs through your work. You mentioned it a moment ago. You went to Catholic schools, right? You went to...
Yes, I did, yeah.
Bishop Ford, right? The late lamented Bishop Ford?
No, my brother went to Bishop Ford. I went to Xaverian.
Oh, okay. All right. But I saw it in the way that you photographed some of the icons in your family's apartments, and you focused on these great church processions that would come right around
right.
this time of year.
Right.
So, you know, and then I saw that you wrote this wonderful essay for your alma mater Fordham called Guardian Angels. So you got this line about
right.
the flickering candles and statues on my grandmother's dresser in her Brooklyn apartment fascinated me when I was a boy.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
It was spooky. It was this real dark apartment, and, you know, sometimes it would be like, you know, 20 kids, and like all the, so my grandmother had eight children, four boys, four girls that lived. Several more died, you know.
Mm.
My four uncles also all went to World War II. They all came back. And we had these big family gatherings. And in this crowded little apartment with it used to be a Cold War flak, but there was a little bed, a war closet in the hall. And I remember lying in my grandmother's bed, listening to that famous Giants game when Baltimore won in overtime.
Ah,
yeah. It was all dark, this little radio and the altar with the candles and the lights. That's the image that comes to mind.
Well, it seems to have stuck with you, whether you wanted it to or not, because...
Good way to put it.
You know,
Andrew Greeley, the writer, sociologist, always wrote that if you got people when you're young and got these images into their mind, they were so visceral and visual that you'd keep them. Like, I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I'm always drawn to religion, and I was photographing all the... I went to an apartment, if there was an altar, I photographed the altar. If a person had a tattoo, I asked if I could photograph the tattoo. And all these wound up being in my exhibit at the Museum of Biblical Art. Word on the Street.
That's your book, Word on the Street.
It's a catalog from an exhibit.
Uh-huh.
And I read about this museum. It was funded by the American Bible Society in this beautiful space on Columbus Circle. And it was called the Gallery of the American Bible Society, and then eventually it incorporated as the Museum of Biblical Art. And they basically had a 5-year window to raise funds, and they didn't raise enough, and then the Bible Society sold the building. So the museum basically dissolved, but they had some incredibly beautiful shows there. And I saw an article in the New York Times about a show on religious quilts. And I thought to myself, well, if those are interesting, what about all the stuff I had, the tattoos, the building walls, the small churches, the processions? And I wrote them a letter, and they said, come in and show us your work. And they said, we'd like to give you a solo show. The first living person there had a solo show. It was tremendously exciting.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It was huge, and it was soup to nuts. They paid for the printing. They paid for the framing. They paid for the catalog.
That was wonderful. They
said, you worked so hard. And you're such a nice guy. We want to give you $5,000 for your efforts. Which I couldn't believe. Are you kidding?
Well, you deserved it.
Yeah, and the book, the book exists. It's out of print, but the book exists. And I have a lot of the work.
You know, we had one of your fans, your fellow photojournalist David Gonzalez, on this show a few weeks back. And one of his big efforts was writing about a storefront church in East Harlem that he really dug into and wrote a great series of stories about the people and how it came to be. And that's, you know, that thread seems to, you know, you've picked it up. You've got those photos of the storefront churches. You've got the photos of the tattoos of the Sacred Heart on so many people, right?
Yeah. The churches are very beautiful. And if you look at, I grew up in these big Catholic churches, and it was kind of cold. And these little churches have so much meaning. And the famous quote from the Bible that if I ever publish my series is when two or more are gathered in my name, there I am. So you don't need the fanfare, you don't need the marble, you don't need all the big fancy stuff, the robes, the vestments. You know, I was very influenced by the Catholic Worker when I was younger.
How so?
I got to meet Dorothy Day once, and I still believe in their mission. And those are the kind of Catholics I didn't grow up with.
Tell us just about meeting Dorothy Day.
Do what I say, not what I do. Like a lot of people who talk the talk, they didn't walk the walk.
Tell us briefly, Larry Rasiopo, about meeting Dorothy Day. I didn't know that. How did that come about?
Yeah. What happened was I was working in a photo studio, and we do these food shots, and we use, I don't know, 100 half gallons of ice cream to get one shot, and we'd just be throwing them out. So I asked my boss if I could bring them to the Catholic Worker, and he said, okay. And I did, and when I went there, she needed a ride to Grand Central Station. So I had a little Volkswagen Bug, and I gave her a ride to the train station. I still get the paper.
Is that right? Good for you. That's great. You've also been writing some wonderful short essays on a website I was not familiar with, but I am now. It's terrific. Mr. Biller's Neighborhood. And you did one on just this month on the St. Patrick's Day marches, which I guess you've been shooting. Not the big one on Fifth Avenue, but the local ones in Brooklyn and elsewhere. Those caught your eye.
I see Manhattan is so photographed. I photographed Halloween. I think I've missed 1 or 2 years of photograph on Halloween since 1974. But there are so many people photographing the parade in Manhattan, I kind of leave that to them and go to smaller, more out-of-the-way places, also places closer to home.
Right. Well, it's a lovely little essay and accompanied by some great photos. And you did another one for them about pizza parlors.
I'm very experienced there. I've eaten a lot of pizza.
Well, you've got one which I forget, maybe it's in Brooklyn before, but it's Nina's Bakery on Myrtle Avenue and this.
Yeah, that was part of a very interesting 2-year period where I was chosen for this really interesting project called the Cultural Council Foundation's See the Artist Project. And there was an exhibit up now. It's the last week of the show at City Lore on the Lower East Side, where this New York City hired 500 artists to make art, and it was signed to community groups. And I was assigned to a not-for-profit in Fort Greene, and you were told to photograph certain things for the not-for-profit, and then also to walk around the neighborhood and just photograph and document the neighborhood. So I was walking around Myrtle Avenue, which I didn't know at one time had kind of a small Italian-American pocket.
Yes.
I went to some restaurants in that little pizzeria where the people are standing in front of Nina's pizzeria.
Right, right. And the proprietor is sort of leaning in the door like he's right. worked all day. He's a little weary, but he'll pose.
Neckerchief and a T-shirt.
Let me ask you about taking pictures of people, Larry Rasiopo. Now, in many of your photos, you have asked people to address the camera, and you don't sort of just take them on the sly. Is there a what is your thinking there? As a photographer?
I feel that's kind of not right. I mean, sometimes I'll do distance photographs to show a scene, but if I'm photographing a person one on one, they have the right to say no, and I want to see their faces. Like for example, I'll do an activity. I have another one of my books to be is about the scrap industry and scrap in New York City. So you'll see someone pushing a shopping cart along Third Avenue, say. And I try and get in front of them and ask to take the picture. Occasionally I'll take something from the back to show you how they're working with the traffic, how dangerous it is. If I'm going to photograph the person solo, I want to ask their permission.
Uh-huh.
And that's how you get, Diana Arbus's pictures are straightforward. The person is engaged with the camera. Walker Evans' photographs are engaged with them. There's something to be said for pictures on the sly, but I don't really care for them.
Uh-huh.
I think they're less.
Uh-huh.
There may be an occasional winner. If it's like if you had the extra gunman in Dallas, that would be a picture. It wouldn't matter front or back. But if you're going to do a portrait, it's kind of like an engagement. It's an interaction. Going all the way back, August Sander are the most earliest portraits.
Well, you certainly have made the most of it because every single one of them, people sort of bring, even though they're, when I take them, they're just photos where people are grinning ear to ear. But your people, when they pose for you, you capture something else that's really, it's always winsome.
You have to. I could find some good ones if you have contact sheets or digital files. Because it's like, a lot of it is like you work a lot. Every photograph isn't a winner. Back in the day, you had contact sheets where you would take the negatives and glass over the negatives and a piece of photo paper. And if you shot 35 millimeter, you have 35 pictures on a page. And you look at them with a magnifying glass. And you say, well, this one is good, that one's bad, I like this one, not that one. So you don't really print every picture you take. You're always editing and selecting.
Right.
Even the best photographers, when you are picking and selecting.
You know, one of my...
Magnum now is selling the contact sheets of their famous photographers. So you might see a very famous photograph in a circle with a grease pencil, but you see the whole contact sheet. Because people like to see how the photographer's mind works, and I use it as an editing tool when I teach. I tell people to do that. Mm-hmm. And now you have all the files on your computer screen, like Google thumbnails. But back in the day, you have a contact sheet.
Right. And take a big grease pencil and circle
that's
the ones
it.
You like. I used to see it at the Daily News. That's how they would do it.
They put the crop marks on it if they wanted to crop it.
Oh, yeah, the big crop marks.
Right?
That was crop out anything that they don't like.
Don't forget, it's a funny thing. You mentioned stuff I'm writing. Well, one of the things, the photographs are really driving the writing. And I'm trying to get Mr. Belmer to help me use more photographs. Because you have a writer and then you commission a photographer to illustrate the story. I'm doing the opposite. I'm writing to fill in and give more information on the photographs. So it's really, for me, the photographs come first. And since the pandemic, I've not been photographing as much. And I have this 50-year archive of negatives. I'm sitting in a room with them now.
Mm.
And I brought a really good scanner. I'm going back through all this work that I either missed or didn't print. Sometimes I'm scanning images I printed, but very often I'm scanning and printing things that I didn't do back in the day. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the money. I didn't have a darkroom. I can tell you, I was always trying to have a darkroom. Sometimes I had my own. I have a storefront. I shared a storefront with my brother's band. I would print during the day. When they came in to rehearse, I would leave. Because they would rehearse, the same song for hours, but we shared these little storefronts in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, my friend and I had set up a darkroom in his basement, and we were printing, and suddenly all the lights turn on, and his mother yells down, "I know you're smoking pot down there. Cut it out!" And it ruined all the prints.
Did that make you a better photographer, you think, printing your own stuff back in the day?
And I think that's a big help. I think you see the end product as like beginning, middle, and end. I mean, a lot of photographers I've met over the years, like some very famous ones, like started out printing their own. Then if they got a gallery and were selling work, they hire a printer. So at one point, when I learned how to print in color, I rented a dark room in Manhattan at a fabulous place that's still in operation called My Own Color Lab. You went in with your negatives and a box of photo paper, and you rented a room for like $10 an hour with an enlarger, and you'd make your print, put it in a light-proof box, and go into the room where the processor was. You put it in the back, and the print would come out dry 15 minutes later, and you'd look at it. And you would say, okay, it needs more blue, or it's too dark, and you'd make another print, and you'd do the same process until you got one you liked. And so there were photographers there printing for themselves, and as they got more successful, they hired someone to actually print for them, and they'd sit there, and the person would make the print and say, what do you think? Right. And the artist would say, do it again, make it darker, right. And the person would repeat the process. And then eventually they would not even show up. The person would do a bunch, and they would just come and get them.
Well, that's no way
so
to work. That's
you start out often printing yourself, right. And then you go away from it because it's more, basically it's more fun and more lucrative to actually photograph. But I kind of like the whole process.
All right. Let me remind folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and the show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but more importantly, we're talking to our guest, the great photographer, photojournalist Larry Rasiopo. You mentioned a moment ago your work on scrap workers. Tell us briefly about what that project
right.
is. What
do you... Well, again, it's one of those things. I don't start out with the idea one day I want to photograph the scrap industry. As I drive around the city and I start seeing it, when I was working as a carpenter in Park Slope, the plumbers would take stuff and put it aside, the old copper, and it turns out you could sell it.
Sure.
Depending on the amount, a truck would come and get it, and you would bring it to a scrap yard. And I started paying attention, and then I would see people going down the street with an air conditioner right. and an AMP cart.
Right.
And I realized they were picking up pipe, metal,
right.
and they would sell it somewhere. I just would talk to people. I found it interesting. What I liked about it was kind of like a cowboy industry. You could work for yourself. If you had, you see people, these old sagging pickup trucks.
Right.
I thought of them as like old cowboys, and they go around the job sites, and then sometimes I'd just be driving and see someone pushing a cart, and I was driving down Third Avenue in Sunset Park, and I saw this guy on the other side of the, I was heading to Park Slope, on the side going to Bay Ridge was a guy with an A&P cart filled with stuff, and on top of it, a refrigerator.
Right.
And I realized he was going to go all the way down 3rd Avenue and turn onto Hamilton Avenue to go to Benson Scrap, which is on Smith Street on the
right.
canal.
Lo and behold, it's a big scrapyard. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I drove around to photograph him and talk to him. And he was in great shape. He was just in denims, shorts, no shirt. And he was, you know, really sweaty. And it was the summer. He's pushing this thing, and he was going to get money for it. He was in, you know, good spirits. It was like the people that you mentioned seeing in the rundown apartments. You could be in bad situation and still have a good spirit and still be alive and still have energy. And I found these people fascinating. And many people say, yes, I can photograph them. Some say no. And I found with the whole scrap thing, I was also finding I got lost in Staten Island. One of my favorite parts of the HPD job was giving maps, and you know them as the Sanborn maps.
Yeah.
And I'd photograph projects for what was called the ULURP, the Uniform Land Review. So before the city could build, they had to have pictures of a site and all the surrounding areas.
I'm not sure folks know what a Sanborn map is, but you might just describe it. There actually are things of beauty, aren't they? Every block and every lot.
The maps themselves, when people come in, they're pink and they write on them and, you know, glue stuff down. They're actually beautiful.
Maybe.
It's like an old Bible.
Yeah.
And so I would be driving around. I'd have the Xerox. I wouldn't have the Sanborn maps. I have copies from the planning department. And I very often ran into demapped streets. So I was trying to find a street that was no longer on the map. So I was out in Staten Island, and I was, I'm trying to think what it's called. It's near Arthur Kill. And I was saw this big scrap yard, and behind it was this beautiful, the original Bayonne Bridge. Now there's a second one.
Right.
And And I drove into the scrapyard for directions, and I saw these stacked cars, like, you know, 10 cars high on either side, framing this beautiful bridge. And it was a trailer with a bunch of guys. I walked in, and I said, can you help me? I'm here for me. I had a city car, so right away people were suspicious. They all stand up and surround me. And so I'm here just for directions, but I'm really amazed by your sight. And I talked to this guy, and I'm like 6 foot, 220 pounds, and they're all bigger than me.
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you want? So I really think this place is interesting. Can I come back on the weekend and photograph it with my big camera? And they're like, what do you want to photograph it for? And I'm like, well, I think it's really beautiful. And they all start laughing. And I said, well, can I? And I said, okay, come back on Saturday. And I know the time of day I want to come for the light. It's like 11 o'clock. Yeah. And I said, God, I'll be here Saturday 11 o'clock, but what's your name? And he said, Vinny.
Yeah,
I said, okay.
Vinny's
so
enough.
I go there that following Saturday. I drive in my own car. People still surround me. And they said, what do you want? And I said, well, I'm here to take pictures. And they said, what do you mean? Who said you take pictures? I said, Vinny. He goes, they go, okay, yeah, okay, go ahead. So I say to the guy, listen, I want to walk around. Do I have to worry about any dogs? And the guy, they look at each other and
good
go,
question.
Ah, yeah. Where are the dogs? And I found that either, especially places like Scrapyards, either, no, you can't go in, or go in, we don't care about you. You know, there's no supervision. There's no person going with you. Like, I photographed out at Governor's Island when it was still a Navy base. Mm-hmm. Every step I took, there was a lieutenant walking next to me.
Yeah.
You know, this is like you're on your own.
Right.
And it's beautiful, like this metal, these workers, you know. Like, it's just, like, incredible to have the opportunity to photograph.
Well, I look forward to seeing that project. That sounds like some great stuff. And you've got another book in the works. I know it has a great title, Here Down on Dark Earth. You say it's about loss and remembrance. Tell us about that.
It's a line from Jack Kerouac. It's a Jack Kerouac poem. Here down on dark earth before we all go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, I just turned 74, so I'm definitely feeling my mortality. The pandemic, I've been kind of homebound for the last 2 years. And I've been really thinking about, you know, the passing of time, death. There's no one is left from my parents' generation. I'm the oldest, but some of my first cousins have passed in the last 2 years. So I'm realistically thinking, how much time do I have left? What more can I do? And I'm thinking about loss and then how we remember people. And I guess the nearest thing that really got me going, I've been photographing these memorial walls all along. And I photographed some family funerals all along. But then what kind of put them together was I lived down the block from St. Francis de Sales Church. And after the attack on the World Trade Centers, about 50 people from Rockaway were killed, either traitors or first responders.
Right.
And there were masses, two or three masses every day right up the block. And I thought of the wonderful pomp and circumstance for heroes' deaths. And I thought about people in my family, like one of my uncles died a month after September 11th, just died in the hospital. 75-year-old guy, worked all his life, raised his family, no fanfare, small little wake. One little tombstone, and I thought, how do you remember? What's the difference? Is his life any less valuable than a hero, or is it any less valuable than a soldier, or any less valuable than a rich person? So I was tying all this stuff together, like if you have money, you endow a chair, you have the Guggenheim Fellowship, you get a wing of the Met, and if you're a poor person, you write in concrete, I miss Daddy, and who sees it? And I started putting all this together and interconnecting, and I started seeing the same kind of things, like the same flowers and symbols are in this a famous person's grave and a nobody's grave.
Hmm.
And I just connecting them, but visually and by type. Like there's a famous little chapel on the campus of York College that you wouldn't know about. It was called the Chapel of the Three Sisters. Some very wealthy person built a chapel in honor of his three dead daughters.
Is that right? I did not know that.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. Now it was collapsing. The city repaired it. Now it's a jazz center.
Huh.
I go on I'm coming up the subway stairs with the same kind of tile, interior gray, beige tile, is a guy sitting with a picture, my brother died, and a little box of contributions sitting on the stairs as you go up the subway stairs. But the framing and the light and the similar.
That's great. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to tell people, though, before we leave, that they should be sure to check out your website, LarryRacciopo.com. That's two P's in please in Racciopo, LarryRacciopo.com. A lot of wonderful, wonderful material there. Thank you so much, Larry Racciopo, for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure, Tom, as always, talking to you.
It's always great. Thanks so much, folks, for listening. Thank you, Ace Engineer Reggie Johnson, for your help. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Oliver Nelson's tune, Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone.
Tune to listener sponsor WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
I certainly couldn't become a part of the Hollywood white group. I was never allowed to act really with another white person in a scene. I was pinned to the pillar so I could be cut out of the scene if it went to places in the South where it couldn't be shown.
Lena Horne, actress, singer, dancer, and civil rights activist, worked at the Cotton Club on Lenox Avenue in the 1930s.
That was the place that was the showcase for Negro talent. And one had to have some place to show one's creativity. Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, the great Ethel Waters. Negro people finally who worked under a roof in a cabaret that was a little better than a basement downstairs somewhere, and not a tent show in the South. But on the other hand, I was torn because it was a dreadful place that was bad working conditions, little money, no respect paid to its creative people, and our own people couldn't come and see us perform. One didn't say too much about it because one then would get all the men fired who were waiters there, and one would get all the girls fired who took care of their families by working there.
Horne says the Cotton Club was a trap. She later performed at the March on Washington on behalf of the NAACP and SNCC. Her career was sidelined for a while by the Hollywood blacklist. She was trailed by the FBI for decades. A memo in Horne's FBI file in 1948 says she's sympathetic to the communist cause and is extremely race conscious. You can receive our extensive women's history audio collection with Lena Horne and some of her music and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for $15 or more a month. You'll also receive WBAI's fabulous tote bag, please go to women.wbai.org. Again, that's women.wbai.org to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite radio program or in the name of all WBAI radio shows, which many people have been doing. Call 212-209-2950. That's another way that you can become a WBAI buddy. 212-209-2950. And say, yes, I want to become a WBAI buddy on this Women's History Day. Thank you. I was born this way.